Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Ruckers, we are back with another extraordinary weekend of Six Nations rugby to dissect. The majesty of France, the misery of England, the madness of events at Murrayfield, where Ireland defied all those injury setbacks to tee up a Grand Slam shot next Saturday in Dublin on St Patrick's weekend against England. And there was relief for Wales, who won the Wooden Spoon Showdown in Rome. Now, joining us later to discuss whether Andy Farrell's men can seal that slam, and to review just how well Keane Healy and Josh van der Vlier masqueraded as hookers, will be Bernard Jackman, the former Ireland and Leinster hooker. In the studio, we have myself, Alex Lowe. We have Will Kelleher.
Hello.
Hello, Will. And down the line, because he's got coaching duties later, is Stephen Jones. Hello, Steve.
Morning. Morning, Alex. Will.
Talk us through your coaching commitments first up. You're updating your coaching qualifications?
Yes, I am. And I've got to coach a team for 6 months, a proper team. So I can't name them because they don't want the publicity, but which will I will automatically draw, of course. But today we're just going to sort ourselves out, see what replacements we got, who's up for it, who's not up for it, and then we're going to take it from there.
Steve, right. Are they as good as old Belvedere under 12s, who Andy Farrell said they might have to draft in with all these injuries?
They're a lot older than old Belvedere under 12s, so I think they probably are better, but They love their rugby, and I wouldn't say I love coaching because some of them are a bloody pain, but I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, we've got so much to talk about on the Six Nations. We have to start with England's record defeat by France. We'll head over to Rome, and then Bernard Jackman will join us to talk Ireland and their Grand Slam prospects. That is all coming up on the Ruck. Okay, Twickenham. Saturday afternoon, 10 minutes from the end, there are thousands of fans streaming out. We thought that the boos at the end of the South Africa game in the autumn were unprecedented, which they certainly are in my experience. I'd never seen that many people leave Twickenham early. As thrilled as they must have been by what they'd seen from France and Antoine Dupont and Jonathan Danty, who I just thought was mega, they were so dejected, disgusted, disappointed by what they saw from England. Steve, you have the job on a Saturday afternoon of filing a match report live on the final whistle. Your take was as much about the beauty of what France had delivered as the beastly performance that we saw from England. How did you see it live, and how did you come to the conclusion that this was also an occasion for a rugby fan to savour what they saw from France as much as be dejected from what they saw from England?
I did, and I have to say I was really disappointed by the fans, because even at the worst times, and we've seen together, the three of us, we've seen some pretty bad times, they haven't poured out like that, Alex. But I have to say that, first of all, I just felt sorry for the likes of Steve Borthwick. I mean, he's had no time at all. I'm afraid, pin all the blame or 90% of it on the previous era. But then I'm thinking, look, We're neutrals. We live in England, but we're neutrals. And we cannot start, in my opinion, with downing, being a downer on England when we saw such magnificence. And what I thought it was, the brand new French team, which got powerful forwards, but doesn't bicker, doesn't give away an avalanche of penalties, and defends beautifully with almost like the Denis Charvet era where they played brilliant rugby as well. And it was a sublime combination of the old France and new France that I thought was absolutely magnificent. And to sign off with that one phase try, glory France, and that is the impression I got. I don't know about you guys. That is the impression I still lose with me now. And God, Jonathan Donty, thank God he wasn't fully fit.
The one thing I was going to say on the back of that, Steve, was, and I picked it out for Monday's Times, and we'll do a bit more on it for the Monday More for Time subscribers, but just the cleverness of two of France's tries was extraordinary. The first one, which happened in a minute and 30 seconds, it was a pass from Ramos that beat, I think, four different England defenders and sent Olivon into a channel between Willis and Lawrence, where England were narrow. And I think if you pause the tape, you can see, I think there are nine England players honey-potted around a ruck, and one pass beats four of them, and then they're away. And Flamont's outside, then there's offload try. And then the last one, it's just a classic case of ID, as they'd say. So in the midfield, England have Jack Walker, the hooker, and Ben Curry, the flanker. And France produce a fairly simple but very well-connected move where they throw a pass out the back. Fiku comes in a nice short line to commit Smith and Farrell, and it's an easy running on the outside. And you just think, it's just so well-organised and collected together. And actually, the thing that we talked about after the game was a lot of the stuff was England were overpowered. Steve Borthwick was saying we're overpowered. We didn't win the gain line. We didn't dominate. So did Jamie George. So did others. And that's actually what it looked like. But it's such a weird thing sometimes, stats, because England had 20% more dominant carries than France. They carried 248 metres within contact and France only 189. And they made more dominant tackles than France too. So actually, it wasn't them being overpowered. It was them being outthought and outfought.
I think they were overpowered, but they're not on the floor, though. England seemed, for all the conversation before the game was England's selection of Marcus Smith at 10 and how they were intending to play with this positive intent and try and get, obviously they have to have a foothold up front and then try and be creative to get around what France were going to bring. It never even got to that because England never got that foothold, because basically Sean Edwards did for England once again. Mm. He sits at his house just outside Perpignan watching all the top 14 games, studying breakdowns. That's one of his responsibilities. And on both sides of the ball, France dominated the collisions. Their ball was quick. England's ball was slow. Whenever England thought they were getting somewhere, Jonathan Donty pounced on it. That was the core of this particular game. England's set piece, the line-out worked well, the scrum was fine. But the breakdown area, just that's where it all focused for England. They couldn't get anything going there. And that's where I think they were overpowered. But I wonder how much of that was felt like mentality more than body weight. I mean, England had a heavier pack.
By 10 kilos, yeah.
It's not about size. It's about, it was about mentality. Mm. England felt like they had no energy or intensity. They felt, it looked like they were meek at times.
From the first minute. Literally from the first minute. Like if anyone wants to go back and look at the tape on ITV, I think there's two occasions in the first 10 minutes where England players are walking to breakdowns and walking off the defensive line, which is just totally unacceptable. And actually, it's one of those things, as much as you can have a game plan, as much as you can want to play wide and fast, which is what we were told last week by the England camp, the thing that they've also said from the start is that the fight is non-negotiable. And we thought we'd get that with an Ellis Genge captain team, that you'd see sort of all snorting and angry. And as much as they haven't had lots of time together and they sent their fly half away for a game rather than having him in camp, that was a tactical decision they made. You just thought that they would be fizzing and up for it. And you just, from the first minute, saw that they just weren't. And that is a very strange situation to be in.
Steve, I'll come to you now. But the other point that connects all of this is, yes, France dominated those physical exchanges. And Steve, you're right. Their execution was scintillatingly accurate, slicing England open beautifully. Whereas England's execution, even when they weren't under pressure, was woeful. We sat next to each other, Will and I, just commenting on the lack of accuracy of, you know, in that, again, first couple of minutes, Van Portfleet gets dragged into a ruck. No one spots it. The ball sitting at the back. Fiku just comes around and picks it up. And careless penalties, loose passes. Some of that is a result of pressure. But it felt like the picture you painted there, Steve, of that sort of clean kill try where they scored it without a finger being laid upon them. England could barely pass from one man to the next at times. The skill levels were down too.
That's where I felt the crowd reacted most, when those horrible things where they made four or five, they just dropped the ball. I think that's where the crowd reacted. But I tell you what, now we have paid tribute to France, quite rightly so, and we'll carry on. But I have to say that this thing about the energy and the power and the resilience that we were meant to see didn't happen, and it didn't happen from the front row upwards.
I think that conversation, which we'll come to in a second, is fascinating, because I'm not sure what options there are. Now, that point about mentality, you just reminded me, last week I had a long conversation with Johnny Wilkinson over at Bracknell Rugby Club. Fascinating.
Well done, Alex. 45.
No, it was, but we talked, one of the points that he has made in the past is invincibility. If you get this sense of invincibility, you stop exploring your potential. And I put to him that maybe that's why France had these wobbles at the start of this championship, because they'd gone unbeaten for 18 months. They'd won the Slam. They had a perfect year last year. Was that why perhaps they just stop exploring their boundaries? And his point was he wanted to see how it affected them. He said either this will rock their confidence and make them question who they are, or it will make them take pause and go, this is not who we are. This is not, we are wasting our talents if we scrape through home, you know, wins against Italy. And I thought what we saw, and I think we'd sensed it coming out of their camp for a couple of weeks. Sean Edwards had been saying one or two things. I felt that this was a France team who came out determined to reinforce to the rugby world who they are and how good they are. And they were under pressure to do so. Whereas England kind of entered it almost as an opportunity, almost as a shot to nothing, let's try this. And that seemed to feed the contrasting intensities of the two teams. Here was a France team who absolutely had to come and reinforce who they were. We haven't seen that level of intensity or desire or absolute sheer bloody-minded, we have to go and perform today, from England very often since the last World Cup. I think we saw it for half an hour in Brisbane on the summer tour, after they'd been embarrassed the week before.
And the Ireland game, when Charlie Ussel got sent off before they ran out of gas.
Yeah.
Sorry, but after he got sent off.
And maybe the end of the Sydney test, when Courtney Laws led a phenomenal goal, sort of goal line stand. We don't see that from England very much. It's felt comfortable.
As you were talking about that Johnny Wilkinson stuff and the French attitude, that's exactly the challenge for England this week. Because, and we had it in the press area afterwards, where I think Ellis Gand and others mentioned, well, we're all going to get written off now and all that sort of stuff. And you go, I think it's fair to say you deserve to be written off after beating by 50 at home. Like, let's just get that one out for starters. And also, this is now a test of your resilience, your mental fortitude and your attitude, more than your skill. They're all talented rugby players. And I remember saying this on the ruck around when Eddie Jones was at the end of his tenure. And you look across that team and you go, Lions players, international 100 cappers. You've got people who've won Champions Cups, massive games in Europe. You've got guys who've beaten New Zealand away in a Lions team. And they fundamentally don't know what to do when the going gets tough. They look soft sometimes, which is a hard thing to say about an international rugby player. That's harsh, but I think fair. There's been a long body of evidence to show that they don't like it up in England. And they're very reactive. They need to be punched in the face before they respond. And actually, they sort of did that after halftime. When Alex Mitchell came on, they went quick, 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 scored a try. But then they folded again. None of this is Steve Borthwick. None of this is Kevin Sinfield. None of this is Nick Evans. And none of this is Richard Cockerell. This is the players. These players are very good players. And they've been far too average for far too long. And frankly, if I was in that England crowd and I'd paid £185. Like, we had a message from a man called Dave McCulloch who said to us earlier, I left after 62 minutes, £158 for the privilege. Half the ground had the same disgusted reaction. No country has had the resources we do, and we've had one Grand Slam in 20 years.
The motivation thing is interesting, because we can all name people, so say games we've seen this year. I mean, I've seen Gloucester play for 18 minutes as if half crazed and brilliant. Saracens too, even someone like the Ospreys, you can see people really, really eyeballs out, sweating with the passion of it. Where is the passion of playing for England, as Will suggests? I just didn't see it. And the first two hits were good, but then they sat back. And you think, come on, boys, who's going to... In the end, you know, you'd rather someone come in like a crazed fool and be red carded because at least it looked like he cared. Well, there was no way anyone in England were going to be carded because they didn't care enough.
We don't condone this at all, but there's one of our number on Saturday night in the press area who's just like, why don't they just have a fight with someone? Like, come on, just show a bit of heart. And look, we're not saying they're cowards. We're not saying that they're terrible rugby players. And we're not saying that they should all be dropped and it's all terrible and everything's gone. And we're also not calling for Steve Borthwick to be sacked or anything like that. But I think there's a fundamental issue here where England consistently don't turn up. And that's full stop.
I think there's a wider... I tried to write about this morning, but you know, Steve Borthwick had to think long and hard and did think long and hard about whether to take the job at the time that it was on offer to him. 2 months before a Six Nations, 9 months before a World Cup. In the end, he took it, I think, out of a sense of duty and opportunity, but he knew what he was inheriting. There would be no quick fix for it. And the reason I think that is you have to look at the landscape and the structures below the senior England men's team. Why is it that Ireland are leading the way? Well, Bernard Jackman will give us some insight further, but we know it's because they have an aligned system. It's a system that works. Now, that's a different... England can't employ that system, but France employ the same system as England, and they've been a basket case for a long time. And Bernard Laporte is not currently the man you'd hold up as as a paragon of virtue, but one of the great things that he did for France was align the club game with the interest of the national team way better than it ever had been before. And they are all pulling in the same direction. Their pathways are evidently... flourishing. The RFU England pathways are desolate at the moment. England used to be guaranteed to make the semi-finals, finals of under 20 World Cups. They now don't. They got thumped on Friday night, the under 20s. The under 20s with potential, those players now struggle for game time because the Premiership system has no money. There isn't room for big enough squads, but they also can't go out on loan. I was talking to coaches earlier in this season about where are all the tight head props, and one of the issues is that clubs can't afford to carry enough tight head props to send the youngster out on loan for matches. That youngster stays in camp and travels as a travelling reserve and never plays. There's a whole issue here below the senior England men's team. And I think it felt to me as I drove home on Saturday night and woke up on Sunday morning that what we've seen, not just on Saturday, but over the course of the last few years, that it's indicative of a fractured, dysfunctional system below it. And I think the next... professional game agreement, which comes in 24, has to completely redraw the whole situation. It's going to need creative thinking. It's going to need innovation. It's going to need some difficult decisions. It's going to need some humility from certain people in power within English rugby to accept that them remaining in absolute power doesn't actually help.
I'm sorry, I would just make one point there, though, that is sort of along the lines you suggest, but also isn't. At some stage in the pod today, you're going to ask Will and I, and then you give us your own views on who England should pick for the weekend, okay? Mm. Now, you'd think, right, there'll be... Do you know what? I cannot think of any real pressing candidates. And the reason for that is Eddie Jones picked something like 130 England players in various squads. He brought them all in. It's more than 10 per club. And we know nothing about them because he dropped them before they proved themselves. And there, you take some, like Adam Radwan, whether you like him or not, we never really found out. You take props, Ben Harris of Wasps, Tom West of Wasps. We never found out. They came in, they were given the status of apprentices, then kicked out again. And there is a whole mass of people out there who we do not know about, so we can't put them in the team because we don't know. We suspect they're better than some of the players here, but because of Eddie Jones, we don't know.
The couple of points I wanted to make on the back of that is, so when we're looking for solutions, 2 points, could this result be England's version of France's 44-8 defeat at Twickenham in 2019, where they just went, right, that's the worst it's going to get. DuPont Untermack next week, and we're sticking with this young team. We're going to have a crack at the World Cup, not expect too much, made a quarter final, unlucky not to beat Wales, and we're going to build for 23. And I know Ruck listeners are going to scream at us and go, oh, I can't talk about World Cups ahead, because that's all what we've been saying about Eddie Jones. You can't look too far ahead. But I think we're at the point now where it's a bit like, right, that's the bottom. So how do you build from here? But the second point I was going to make is, if you look at the good teams around the world, they're built on one very good club side. Sorry, so it's blindingly obvious, but Toulouse dominate the France team, Leinster dominate the Ireland team, the Crusaders dominate the New Zealand team. South Africa, clearly very different because all their players play all over the place. But one of the fundamental problems that England have had is that their dominant team were cheating and got relegated, Saracens. Eddie Jones admitted himself that he didn't deal with that very well. They've then had a team that have won the league in Exeter who have fallen off a cliff. They've had a team that have won the league in Harlequins, which was a complete kind of Hollywood shot to nothing thing that kind of came from nowhere. And you had a Leicester team that did have a bit of a grounded base to it, but was very limited and snuck in. So who do you build your team around? Who's the English? Yeah, but that's the other thing, because then you look at the team for the weekend and you go, the only club partnerships out there were Ellis Genge and Carl Sinclair, who have been playing together for 6 months. I know they've played a lot together for England. You've got Jamie George and Itoje for a bit of line-out, but him and Chesham, not a club partnership. Ludlam, Willis and Donbrandt, not a club partnership. A bit of Smith and Donbrandt, but not playing in the way they do for Quins. Slade and Lawrence, not a club partnership. Stewart and Watson have been playing together for a matter of months because Watson's been so injured at Leicester. Malin's not a club partnership with anyone.
Yeah. So
it's all a total patchwork quilt of messes.
So to answer your point, is this where France were in the Six Nations 2019? I thought England already reached that point at the end of November. And I do feel that Borthwick is having to learn on the fly here. It depends whether you want to be constructive or critical about how he's going about it. Is he having to feel his way through game after game to work out what the identity of his team will be? Because as Steve says, there are so many players, there's always an argument to pick somebody else.
Mm.
And he needs to understand the identity of his team. He also needs to understand what happens if I lose somebody. So Gary Ringrose with Ireland, knocked out, cannot play next week. If that happens at a World Cup to Owen Farrell, what does he do next? He does need to try and he's trying to understand all these things on the fly. And I think he does have, from us, and I hope from the supporters, a license to, nobody will defend what happened on Saturday. I also appreciate
Not blaming him for it. That's what
the situation we're saying, that he is in. Which leads us, I guess, Steve, to the question that you've raised a couple of times. What do you do? What does Steve Borthwick do to this England team in 6 days to go and try and compete in Dublin?
First of all, he doesn't do what Barnsley said this morning. He has got one game to erase some of the awful memories of the weekend. It doesn't matter. He has got to find ways and he's got to find personnel to engage Ireland and make them worried. It doesn't matter if they never play for England again. He's got to go out there against a slightly weakened Irish team and he's got to start reviving the spirit and the sense of devil by stuffing it up Ireland, even if they lose on Saturday. But also, secondly, which is the future thing, I had a long chat with Steve Borthwick the other day, and we both agreed 100% that they must have A fixtures so that we can sort out this undercard. Mm. They must have A fixtures, and all the other countries want them as well. And until that comes back, England will always be swimming in a huge pool and full of sharks.
So this will be fantasy word, because Steve Borthwick has named a training squad for this week, and I'm sure none of the names that you're thinking of, Steve, will be in it. If you could name one player, who would you want to bring in?
If you're an Irish centre, the replacement to Ringrose, who would you not want to mark in a one-off frantic game on Saturday? Tuilagi.
Yeah. Well, I think he will play.
I'd be amazed if he doesn't. He's got especially with Lawrence out, yeah.
And I know he's not in the squad, but look, with the greatest respect, we now know that England haven't got an international number 8, okay? Mm. The one who can be it for half an hour is Billy Vunipola. And that would stop Ireland in their tracks. They've got to find a way to beat up Ireland in certain phases. And even if Ireland comes strong with 5 late tries, they've got to put themselves back on the map this week with physicality and the passion, which, as Will said, was missing on the weekend.
So I think that Billy situation is is fascinating because you're right. He's probably a test player for, you know, he could give it hard for half an hour. But I think Don Brandt has been, he was just out-muscled. He was outclassed on Saturday. And there were times when he didn't seem up for the fight, which is the biggest worry for me. Otherwise, the best number eight, the best English number eights are both playing in France.
Mm. Yes.
Tom Willis at Bordeaux Begler, who has been on the fringes of this England setup but not actually quite been called in. Zach Mercer carving up for Montpellier, who is not eligible.
Surely he comes straight in the summer.
You'd think by the time we get to the summer, Tom Willis and Zach Mercer will both be in a wider World Cup training squad. I just have a feeling that he'll go full throwback to 2019 and go Ford Farrell to Alangi for Dublin. Steve Borthwick sees real benefits in it, real merits in it.
And who are the most cohesive partnership in English rugby and have been for almost ever? Ford and Farrell. Yeah. Know each other since they were kids.
I
the only negative I would say to that is that George Ford still has hardly played that much in 7 months.
Yeah.
A step to a test match is a massive one against the best team in the world.
That's the argument against doing it, for sure, that George Ford is still finding his feet in rugby, having...
Literally, after his Achilles
snapped
off.
Hardly played since a horrific injury. So that's the argument against it.
He doesn't have to play... Look, let's be fair, halfbacks... God knows, God bless Van Poortvliet. God knows, was he playing for instructions? He bent down with his hands on the ball and he didn't lift it for 5 seconds once. Mm. Now, again, you might say it's desperate measures. If anyone's seen Bristol in the last two games, they would know that Harry Randall provides a massive challenge because he's like an electric eel. You never know which way he's going to go. He's got a rapid service, okay? The England centres on the weekend... By the time it went from Van Poortvliet to Smith, who we all know he's a poor defender and a poor kicker, but by the time he got the ball, did a goose step, stopped, started again, and then gave the ball out. No, there was no shortage. Oh, sorry, there was a shortage of quick ball, but England did have quick ball, and he buried it 6 foot under. You've got to change the halfbacks, but I wouldn't have Ford. I'd have Farrell and... And Harry Randall, definitely, even though he's not in the squad, so we're talking slightly superfluously. And I bring George Ford on for the last 20 minutes when he's acclimatised, instead of Farrell, not in the centre.
Can I make three final little points? Because I know we've got to move on. To counter Steve, Marcus Smith is a better goal kicker and has been consistently than Owen Farrell. That's just a fact.
In the last 2 weeks... You're talking about one of the greatest goal kickers of all time.
Smith's kicking percentage is better than Farrell's. And that's
so you
just...
want Smith to stay in the team for his goal kick?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm literally just saying that fact that you said was wrong, but that's fine. The other one is that he also, his defence is, I mean, it might look different, but in terms of purely tackling, is about 1% or 2% less than Ford and Farrell, which is not that bad. Second thing I was going to say is that the nightmare of playing Ford Farrell to Lange is that you change midfield yet again. Mm. Which isn't great. And then the last thing, which is a wider point, is with all this, Steve Borthwick needs some help. He's got a very young, inexperienced coaching team, and it's going to get even more inexperienced and younger when Richard Wigglesworth comes in and Richard Cockerell leaves. He needs some help. He needs some rugby IQ in the building.
Right. We could discuss England-France all day. And I think it was right that we started with praise for France, just as Steve started his match report in the same vein, because a lot of what they did was outstanding. Coming up on the ruck, we will talk to Bernard Jackman about Ireland, Grand Slam chasing Ireland. But first, let's just have a quick chat, Steve, about Wales and Italy. I think most of us felt that this was going to be a tighter game than it turned out to be. The pressure was on Wales. Some senior players were dropped for this game. There was no Dan Biggar, for example. And they produced their best performance of the championship when they really had to, because a wooden spoon would have been grim.
Yeah, it's obviously nice to avoid the wooden spoon. But I think I look at it the other way. It's all very well to say Italy are better, which they are. It's a shame that Capuazzo didn't play. But there's a hell of a difference between being a contender, a genuine contender to win the match, and to actually win it. I always thought Wales would win that game because it almost became too enormous for Italy. So if we don't win this, we're at square one. So I wouldn't go in apart from saying Rhys Webb played well and that Adam Beard finally stirred himself. I wouldn't say that you know, it was glory, glory Wales or anything like that or anything good for the future. But I did think they'd win it, and they did. But we are talking about the wrong end of the table, Alex, as you know.
Yeah, no, I'm not suggesting it's glory, glory. More the fact that maybe they've bottomed out. Maybe this weekend was an opportunity for them to just at least kind of get some kind of sort of something positive to take from it, to talk about. Yeah, some notion that maybe they can bottom out of this.
Definitely, but of course they've got the big match for Wales this year, not even taking place yet. It's in a fortnight's time in a committee room where the old codgers who've wrecked the game, and I mean wrecked the game, murdered the game, taken money from it for doing nothing, will be up, and we need a 75% vote to get rid of them. That's the most important thing. Once that's done, and they can bring in some people who know a little bit about rugby, that's the real set. That's the point when it changes, Alex. If it doesn't change, God knows, they might as well lock up and turn out the lights.
I guess real parallels there, Steve, with what we were discussing earlier with England and Gatland, as I put in my piece today, actually. The success that he managed to bring to the national team for a decade or so papered over the cracks of all the chaos underneath it. And now it feels like the state of the men's national team is indicative of the fractured structure below it in Wales as much as it is in England. And I guess the hope is for people like yourself with roots in the country and in the sport in that country that the necessary change can be forced through, and maybe that can just help turn the tide a bit and bring some hope back. But coming up now, we're going to talk to someone who's in a great mood and in great spirits about the sport in his country, Bernard Jackman. We're going to catch him just before he heads off to the horse racing in Cheltenham.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Joining us now on the ruck from Dublin before he heads over to the Cheltenham Festival, what a week this will be for Ireland, is Bernard Jackman, the former Ireland hooker. Bernard, thanks for joining us.
No, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. Big week, is right. Hopefully we can back a few winners in Cheltenham and we can finish off the Grand Slam on Saturday in the Aviva. But yeah, exciting.
They've set up a wonderful party weekend for all Irish sports fans. Let's head up to Murrayfield. What did you make of that performance? It needed resilience, it needed grit, it needed Ireland to overcome hurdles that don't get thrown at many teams, coming down to Josh van der Fleer throwing into the line out and Keane Healy winning scrum penalties at hooker. What was your overall assessment of that performance and really what it said about Ireland?
I think it was incredible. At half time I was kind of annoyed and frustrated and scared about the World Cup draw because I thought Scotland had gone toe-to-toe with Ireland, and I was saying, how can we have Scotland, you know, a resurgent Scotland and South Africa and Ireland in the same group with only two to come through? And I thought we were going to lose the game, you know, seeing the injuries we had. Doris has been outstanding for us. He went off first, then Dan Sheehan, and then we lost Ian Henderson. And then obviously I could see that Ronan Keller, sorry, was struggling with his shoulder, and I didn't think he was going to come back out after half time. So at that stage, you had to fancy Scotland. You know, they were starting to find holes in us defensively, and they would have had all the momentum. I couldn't see us being able to win a scrum or line out in the second half without a hooker. And how it unfolded for Farrell, bar maybe getting a bonus point, which we had the chance to get, I think it's probably the perfect scenario, because, you know, he's talked about wanting to be tested, wanting to find out how we cope with pressure, how we deal with adversity. We were right in the middle of it on Saturday, you know, in front of a big crowd in Murrayfield against a good team. We found a way out of it. And actually, once we got that try for James Lowe and went two scores ahead when Sexton converted it, there was only really one team in it. You know, we put the foot down, and he's going to be, so obviously he's not happy with the injuries we've had, but in terms of building a squad and I suppose creating that sense of calmness that we're going to have to face as we go on, because sometimes things are going to go against us, whether it's red cards, yellow cards, or injuries like what happened on Saturday. I think it couldn't have been better, really. You know, Barr, as I said, potentially having that bonus point.
Yes.
And, you know, but he's built an unbelievable squad. He's so impressive. And I think he's not just, he has the charisma, but I think tactically, by the people he's brought in with him, Simon Easterby, Paul O'Connor, Mike Cass, etc., Ireland are tactically very smart as well, which you have to be. You know, you can't be just about scale or power. You need to have a balance of lots of different factors.
Take us into the challenge that face Josh van der Vleer and Keane Healy. There's two opposite skill sets there, neither of which they're comfortable with. It struck me that when England were at Murrayfield a couple of years ago, they were without a hooker and had no plan. Was it Joe Marler?
Joe
Marler ended up having to throw in the line out. Finn Russell could see that, exploited it, and England collapsed because of it. Ireland had the planning that has clearly gone into these really extreme scenarios whereby Keane Healy can come in and be comfortable, not only comfortable, but be part of an Ireland pack that wins penalties. And Josh van der Vleer was his number 6 from 7, 5 from 6, throwing in at the line out. Really, really impressive depth of planning, but also skill set. That was your position, Bernard. Just talk through how tough that is for them.
Look, I've been spending since I retired, I'm telling everyone how hard it was to play hooker, you know, how hard it was, how hard it was to throw in a specialist position, and Mark Keane Healy for getting to tap the ball for that quick tap, which is a very specialist skill as the hookers have mastered. I think I'll have to keep quiet. Look, it was brilliant. Josh van der Vleer, he used to get given out in the academy because in the gym, in between sets, he used to practice with the hookers. So obviously, we're very lucky that he's someone who saw that there was potentially an opportunity to add value to himself and the team by being able to throw. So the advantage of that is if your hooker gets sin-binned and there's no scrum and you haven't made a replacement, he can obviously do it in an emergency. And he's possibly thrown in once or twice in a 10-minute period in a game. But to have to start the second half of a test match that's 8-7, and be told, you know, you're out there, you're thrown for the game is incredible. And he threw very well. I think Keane Healy, on our team sheet, he's marked as being able to play loose head hooker or tight head. And I think that's invaluable, because obviously if he can't go in as hooker, you have to go uncontested and we have to go down to 14 men. So, like, I've been maybe wondering, is Keane Healy still worth a place on the bench? Because he's ahead of a guy called Dave Kilcoyne, who's a specialist loose head, who's very, very dynamic. But when you have a player who can cover those three, and you have a set of scenarios that we had at the weekend, it's invaluable. And actually, as you said, you know, it wasn't just that we'd have to go down to 14 men. We didn't have to go down to 14 men. We actually won scrum penalties with Keane Healy there, which maybe played a big role in turning the game. Van der Vleer, after the game, was annoyed himself for missing those two. But he genuinely would be. He's that kind of guy. You know, he's not playing to the crowd. And yeah, it's phenomenal. But apparently, Keane Healy knew his role. What he had to do was a loose head prop and a tight head prop, because he was covering both of those. And there was a chance with Tyke Furlong just coming back from injury, Tom O'Toole being a quite an experienced tight head, and he may have had to go in a tight head. But he said he didn't, and he was kind of saying he didn't actually learn his role about what he had to do as a hooker in terms of the patterns and the power plays. So O'Connell grabbed him at halftime, and they went through all those scenarios. And if you remember, Ronan Keller actually stayed on the field for a little while. Even though he couldn't throw, he was running around the place with one arm. And that gave Healy an extra 5 minutes to be able to get on the field, go in hooker, and know what he was supposed to do defensively and attack-wise, which is, it's just brilliant. I mean, you know, the ability to have that clarity of thought.
Bernard, all that you're talking about there, to me, it just is a fantastic demonstration of the levels that Ireland are at. Because as we mentioned with the England-Scotland situation last year, I would imagine that if that scenario had happened to England, they would have completely collapsed and they wouldn't have known what they were doing. They wouldn't have had a plan. They wouldn't have known who was throwing in. They wouldn't have had someone else to play hooker or at least do it well. And it's one of those things because you can't blame Steve Borthwick for that, perhaps, because he's had four games. It just shows the time spent together, that cohesion word that we always talk about, and also that sort of nous, that streetwise thing that Warren Gatland's Wales teams always used to have, is that kind of just test match experience and knowing what to do. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal. And we have a lot of people like Sexton, Colin Murray, who've been around a long time and understand, I suppose, what you need to do in those situations. Even I thought Sexton, I don't know if you heard him under F Mike, you know, for that quick throw in that Ireland scored a try off, yeah, was called back. He, like, you know, what he said to Luke Pearce was, I want this to be on the record, you know, that I'm questioning this. It's just a subtle way of saying things. Whereas you saw Scotland, they got penalised twice, you know, 10 metres for back chat, you know, and it's not the be on end all, but the reality is if we're to win this Grand Slam, you know, which we put ourselves in a position to do it, it's all those little things added together. And I think Farrell, he's a rugby league originally, but wow, he's proven to be a phenomenal head coach. This is his first head coach role, I think, in his own right. And what he's done with this team is exceptional.
It's such an intangible, isn't it? Like, how do you foster street smarts? Because we've said for years, Alex, that we see a team when wearing white shirts a lot that don't have any nous or any streetwise ability. Where the Saracens players do when they play for their own team, and some of the other club players do for their own teams. But when they wear England shirts, they don't look like that at all. And it was, as I said before, Wales's team under Warren Gatland the first time around sort of 2013 to 2019, they had that in spades, didn't they? And this Ireland team clearly has it. I don't know how you foster that. Where does that come from? And Bernard might be able to help us. I don't know. How do you grow smart? It's such a funny old thing to think about.
Look, I think the fact that we're all aligned. So I'll be honest, in the development system pathways here, whether it's schools or youths, there is a lot of focus on tactical understanding development. So, you know, 16, 17 year olds, whereas in some countries it's about, you know, whether they're quick or whether they're really powerful. We spend a lot of time trying to make sure that they understand the game. And then you go into provinces where I think the coaching is good. There's never any scandals or distractions, if you know what I mean. So, when this stuff about Wales and the Welsh players' contracts came up, like, I remember just saying to somebody, when I played for Leinster or Connacht, bar one, 2002, there was a bit of a chance that Connacht might be made extinct and only go over three provinces. But since then, any rugby player in Ireland, when they go in on a Monday morning and put their bag into their locker, all they think about is getting better. There's no real crisis in the game or fear. There's not really a high turnover of players. So if you're doing your job for your province, you'll probably get renewed. You know, you probably don't want to go play anywhere else because you're playing for your home province to a large extent. You have a chance of winning silverware. The facilities, the coaching, the environment is good. And when you have all those things that are geared towards helping you just get better as a player, I think that helps then. You start to actually look at the next layer. It actually just helps players be able to get better.
But Bernard, you've got a very, very odd sort of mental approach to this game on the weekend. England had just lost by 50. How do Ireland approach that? Is it just to imagine that they're playing the All Blacks or something like that? Because otherwise, if anyone saw England, you'd be forgiven for thinking, blimey, this is going to be easy.
Yeah, I think it's the worst possible scenario for Ireland because, you know, you have to try and, I suppose, create the sense of fear, which obvious, you know, logic says no because of how poor they were against France. But realistically, I think you look at that team that England can put out, you give Borthwick a joker card and you say, look, that's not how England are going to be under Borthwick. They're certainly not going to be as poor physically, you would think, defensively, you know, and you start to prep for that. And Steve Borthwick teams are normally hard to break down and you have to be smart tactically. So Ireland will be prepping for that. The fact that they might play a lot of balls being kicked onto them, how they deal with that, how they exit, when they play, etc., how ambitious they want to be. I think they'll be able to prepare for what I think will come. I think the England have to be better. I mean, England can't come to Dublin and just lie down like they did, sure, against France, or it's going to be very difficult to to bounce back. I know they've got a soft World Cup draw, but if they come and put in a tight performance like they did last weekend, it would be horrendous for them as coaches, individuals, fans. And I just don't see it happening, to be honest. I don't know what happened last week, but I think England are better than that, and we'll be better than that this week.
Can I ask you about your position, your old position up front? Ireland lately, I absolutely have always loved Furlong, because I think that that's the sort of player who used to be around in the game, but now he's back. They're back in his shape. I mean, he's a magnificent rugby player as well as a scrummager. Also, you're talking about pressure being on Healy because someone's coming through. There's lots of hookers there. Just interesting, does this all date back to the sort of Greg Feek era where you decided as a country, look, we're not going to go down the slippery slope here. We're going to go back to scrummaging. We're going to have big, hard scrummaging forwards.
Yeah, Steve, you're spot on. We had you've been around long enough like me to remember crisis in Irish rugby. I mean, we spent the best part of 8 or 9 years praying that John Hayes would get up out of bed on a matchday morning fit. Yeah. And then it was Mike Ross after that. And if either of them were out, I mean, you know, it was good night. So Greg Feek came in, and rather than just be scrum coach for Ireland, he oversaw a front row development plan where they got a lot of coaches. Look, scrum coaches and scrum geeks were a unique breed. We're not falling off trees. So and often, like, clubs with lack of resource, etc., won't have a specialist scrum coach, or didn't. So yeah, what they did was they realized that the provinces could only coach the players that they had in their you know, professional setups, and rather than just spend all the time with them, they actually educated and trained up a bunch of scrum people who are passionate about the scrum around the country. They then started to do the hours on a Monday night, Tuesday night, into schools, etc., coaching and looking for potential front rowers. It's a little bit hard to do because at schools level here, you can only push a meter and a half, right? So there's certain teams who will actually put a flanker in at scrum. So the traditional pathway of props was starting to dry up to a certain extent. And by having all these eyes and ears and scouts and coaches out there in club land, in school land, working with young props or young hookers has been massively beneficial. And it sounds, again, it sounds so obvious, you know, but we had a guy called Greg Feek who was very good at what he did with Ireland. But I think what he did, you know, the rest of the weeks and weekends when he ran these courses has made sure his legacy has outlasted him, and hopefully will last a long time.
Bernard, you're heading off to Cheltenham now. When you arrive back in Dublin on Sir Patrick's weekend for a Grand Slam game against England, what will the mood be like around the city, around the stadium? Is it anticipation? Is it excitement? Or is there a level of anxiety because of that injury list that you sustained at Murrayfield? What do you think the sense will be among Irish rugby fans and around the squad?
I think the injuries will obviously be talked about all week, but I think this Irish team have the trust of the Irish fans. I think they've worked hard to deserve that. If it's anything like France, I mean, France was obviously Ireland number one, V2 in the world. I think 10,000 French fans came over. It was just phenomenal, you know, from the day before, morning of the game, day of the game. And obviously, this is St. Patrick's again. England always travel. English fans always travel. We might be a bit hungover after Cheltenham and Paddy's Day. We might take a while to get going, but I think the atmosphere is going to be electric. Sexton obviously has a chance to pass out. Ron Nogara. There's a Grand Slam. I mean, it's the first time we've only won 3 Grand Slams, I think, in history, and we've never won one at home, you know. And the fact that we're playing England, a team we respect massively, you know, it's St. Patrick's weekend. It's just, you know, the stars have aligned perfectly, and you know, hopefully now we can maximize that and get a win.
I think you'll be fine, Bernard. That 20 years ago, the England team were quite a lot better than they are this year. I think that 0-3 side that were also on for a slam and 1-1. I mean, slightly different. I would suspect.
Yeah, it is. But I do believe. I don't know what you guys think. You know more than I do about English rugby, but I just don't think that was a true reflection of that team at Twickenham. But unfortunately, you know, that's the one that's in our mind now. And if they play like that, it's only going to be one result.
Right, we need to let you head off to the airport, but you can't go without giving us your big Cheltenham tip for the week.
Long pause. Lads,
I'm going with experts. I have to text you. I honestly don't.
Are you going for the racing, or are you going for the Guinness?
No, I go both. But I just about get away with giving tips about rugby. So I'm going to leave it to the experts and wait for them to tell me what to back.
Fair play, brilliant. Great to talk to you. Thanks for your insights. It's been fascinating.
Great to have you on, Bernard.
Cheers, Bernard.
That was great chatting to Bernard, wasn't it? The insight he gave into the development of the front row, apart from everything else, I thought was fascinating. Guys, how do we see this unfolding this week? Is it are there any surprises in store? Will the occasion, will the pressure get to Ireland, or is it going to be a cakewalk for them to the Grand Slam? Steve, what do you think?
I think Ireland will win. I don't think England will concede 50 because I don't think Ireland will be in quite that sort of shape. And it doesn't matter what you think, you know, it is the last game and they'd be slightly tired. But I'd be surprised if it's not a margin of 30, guys. I don't know what you think.
Well,
yeah, Ireland are going to win the Grand Slam. I don't think they're the sort of team that are going to succumb to the pressure. I think, if anything, it'll galvanise them that they've got the home crowd behind them on St Patrick's weekend and all that comes with that. I think England will show far more because they have to. And I think they will take a sort of respectful 10-point, 15-point defeat. We can't expect them to win. And it'd be absolutely extraordinary if they were to get a result, which I don't think they will. But I don't think they'll get hammered because if they go two thrashings in a row, then there's some serious questions about them, aren't there?
Yeah. No, I think the thing that's impressed me, and reflecting back on what I said about my conversation with Johnny Wilkinson about teams that, and it applies to individuals as well as teams, you've got to keep exploring, you've got to keep finding new ways to get to improve. And I think one of the things that Farrell has done so well with this Ireland team, and I think maybe a couple of the defeats they had last year actually helped because they finished the year world number one, but they lost a couple. I think he's kept them driving forward, and the way they dealt with all the setbacks. You know, they've got Josh van der Veer throwing in the line-outs, and Johnny Sexton is so confident he's kicking penalties to touch and inviting those situations. That's the streetwise stuff we were talking about earlier. That's the confidence. That's the depth of where they are. They're striving constantly at the moment to keep evolving, to keep exploring where their potential is, to quote Johnny. And I think it applies to them, and they would deserve to win the Grand Slam because they have been consistently the best team in this championship.
Rugby's mentality monsters.
Indeed, indeed. Right, we need to round off this week's episode of The Ruck with the God or Goddess of the Week. Steve, I'll come to you first. Have you got any thoughts?
Very difficult between Marcus Smith and Mark Evans, actually, because they both make so magnificent. Mark Evans is a great rucker for us, and his team, Fiji and Drua, on the weekend, and a magnificent victory over the Crusaders. Unfortunately, he's far too small and far too stroppy to be a God of the Week. So I'm going for a big man, Cyril Bai. He epitomised everything that was good about France. He carried the ball. He scrummaged for his life. He's huge, monstrous, and would make a great panto villain. So he's my panto villain and God of the Week, Cyril Bai of Toulouse and France.
I respect that nomination greatly. I think brilliant for Mark Evans, who's a friend of ours, someone we all like and respect enormously. The job he's done.
We don't like him.
Well, okay, Will and I do in the studio. He's gone down to be the chief executive of Fiji Drua, who had a couple of real narrow results last season. And to win at home in the way they did, if you get the chance to see some of the footage, that the stadium is in Suva, I think it was in Suva or Lautoka.
Lautoka
was jumping. Looked extraordinary scenes and brilliant for the sport. And 2 days afterwards, we've done a little story this morning about the Lions tour schedule in 2025 is set to include a game against the Pacific Islands 15.
How cool!
How cool is that? Because if you imagine, the Pacific Islanders have toured three times as a combined team, most recently in 08 when they played England.
It was like Dylan Hartley's debut Twickenham. And that, wasn't it?
It was certainly Martin Johnson's first game as England coach. But if you think of the Pacific Islands combined 15 that you could pick
awesome.
To take on the Lions.
Awesome.
I mean, if they want to sell out the MCG, they'll sell out the MCG for that. Because you call in, I mean, a great favourite of ours, Theo McFarland, he could get in it. Semi Randrandra can get in it.
Piatau,
Fekitoa. Wow. I mean, wow, what a team that could be. And that's to come for the Lions in a couple of years' time. So a well-deserved honourable mention for Mark Evans there. Will, who's your...
Well, I was just going to say, there was a great tweet from Jamie Wall, who's a reporter over in New Zealand, who overnight was watching the France-England game, said, yeah, France impressive, but can they do it on a hot Saturday afternoon in La Toca? It was a great line.
That's a cracker.
I think it's got to be a Frenchman, and you could pick anyone, but I think both of us were sold a dummy by Dupont, where he, as well as the entire England team, where he feigned to box kick with his right foot, but realised that England thought he was going to do that and were swapping Jack Van Portfleet with Freddie Stewart. So instead, just banged it a 50-22 with his left foot. He was just taking the mickey. That was just so good. And he's, we thought he was having a dip. That I'd like to have a dip like that. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I don't know how you pick anyone out of that France team without, because you could pick anyone, couldn't you? You could pick Oliver. You could pick Aldrete, Donty, who I just, he made such a difference for me in that team. And and I know from, I went to see Sean Edwards just before Christmas, and he talked about how important Jonathan Donty is to that France team clicking. And my goodness, did he not make a difference for them? So out of that France team, I'd pick him. I want to give mention to Keane Healy. Just love what he did coming on, no fuss, sorted out the, you know, one scrum penalties and a hooker. Brilliant. James Lowe was outstanding. Just so many wonderful performances. But I'm going to give it to Jonathan Donty, because he seemed to me to be the guy who just took France. His presence alone helped take France to another level and produce one of the great performances. Gents, we'll be back in a week's time to review the final round of the Six Nations Championship. We all think it'll be a Grand Slam to be discussed. We shall wait and see. But Steve, Will, everyone listening, thanks very much for joining us, and we'll be back in a week's time.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.